Hi, I'm Laura Kanoy, and the holiday season is a great time to take stock of the things we're grateful for, like family, a good meal, or listening to a well-told story. NHPR has been by your side all year, serving you and your community with thorough, dedicated news, right alongside moments of gratitude that offer perspective. As this year comes to a close, we hope you consider showing your gratitude by making a year-end gift. Give now at nhpr.org. From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Today marks a profound moment for every American who longs for this pandemic to be over. Later this afternoon, a Food and Drug Administration advisory committee could vote on whether to clear the way for a vaccine from the drug maker Pfizer, already approved by Britain and Canada. The FDA panel is expected to say yes. If so, that sets in motion an enormous, complex process to get Granite Staters vaccinated. And it raises a new series of questions that are just starting to be answered. Today in The Exchange, we want to know what questions you have about the vaccine, from how it works to who goes first, to how long it will take before it helps us return to normal. Join us with a phone call to 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org, or use Facebook. Before we begin, I want to acknowledge the death yesterday of New Hampshire House Speaker Dick Hinch, a Republican state representative from Merrimack. We will have more news of Speaker Hinch's passing on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup tomorrow. Now to our conversation about vaccines. Our guests are Matthew Fox, professor of epidemiology at the Boston University School of Public Health. Also, Kendall Hoyt, assistant professor at Dartmouth's Geisel School of Medicine and a lecturer at the Thayer School of Engineering. And Dr. Tim Leahy, an infectious disease physician, director of medical ethics and a professor at the University of Vermont. Well, welcome, everyone. It's a big day, and I really appreciate you taking the time. And Dr. Leahy, starting with you first, I'd just like you to reflect on this day and this moment. I mean, here we are with the first vaccine expected to be approved.
Good morning. I think it's incredibly exciting news. It gives me hope that as communities, we'll get through this. I want to be pragmatic about it and know that there's still a lot of work to be done to make sure that we get these vaccines to communities safely. But with the ways we're pulling together to wear masks and not congregate, this is going to be a critical tool to get normal life back eventually.
How are you feeling, Dr. Leahy? I mean, are you feeling elated? Are you feeling cautious? You sound a little cautious there, I have to say.
Well, you know, I'm fired up in general that actually the human race has been able to develop protective vaccines this quickly. It's remarkable. Yeah. I never would have predicted it. I also am knee-deep in the work to try to figure out how to get a vaccine to as many people as need it, and that is going to be a historically large undertaking.
Oh, that's interesting, and we'll definitely talk about sort of the how and the who in a moment. But Professor Fox, how about you? You're a professor of public health. What's going through your mind right now?
Yeah, much like Dr. Leahy, I'm having sort of some mixed emotions. So on the one hand, when we got the news that the vaccines were looking to be effective, and today it's looking like they'll probably be approved. It was really exciting news, and it's giving us hope that we are going to get back to something normal not too long. But, you know, as a public health professional, it is part of my job to worry about the worst case scenarios and try to do everything we can to prevent them. And the thing that I do worry about is that now that people have a sense that the vaccine is coming, that people may start to let down their guard. And I think New Hampshire is a perfect example, because New Hampshire has done so well at mitigating the severe impacts of the disease. But much like what we've seen in the Midwest, just because it hasn't happened there yet doesn't mean it can't happen. And so I really do want to emphasize that people are still going to need to take precautions until we have wide-scale distribution of the vaccine.
Oh, it's interesting. And how about you, Professor Hoyt? What thoughts or feelings are coming up for you at this amazing moment, really?
It's remarkable. It really is. I mean, it's been 10 months since from the time that we identified the new virus to the time that we had evidence of efficacy. And it you know, thousands of things had to go right for that to work, starting with the decision to target the spike protein on the surface of the virus. So for anyone who's followed mRNA vaccines, this is really a moment to dance in the streets. But the key now, obviously, is making enough of it and getting it into the arms of enough people to end transmission.
Well, and that's your expertise, Professor Hoyt, because as I said, you're not only at the Geisel School of Medicine, but you're also at the Thayer School of Engineering. So you've been looking at the manufacturing and the distribution process. So if you could, Professor Hoyt, please describe the practical challenge of getting these millions of vials manufactured and shipped in a timely and safe way.
Right. So a million things need to go right again here too. So Operation Warp Speed is designed to have vaccine delivered to 50 states within 24 to 48 hours of an emergency use authorization declaration, which could happen, you know, by the end of today. But then states need to, they don't know how many doses they're going to get, and they need to hire staff, right? And they don't even know how many people they need to be hiring. And what you're going to have is a very, you're going to need to have very high throughput with central distribution, because this Pfizer vaccine requires an ultra cold chain, you know, negative 94 degrees Fahrenheit. And so you can't be sending little bits of it off in many different places for more distributed distribution. So you're going to have to be organized to not waste vaccine. So there's the ultra cold chain problem. There's a data management issue, right? So you have to vaccinate the same people again 30 days later, and you need to track their symptoms. And then as we get further down the line, you're going to have supply chain issues. So there's going to be crushing demand for glass vials, syringes, needles, raw ingredients, and we can expect to have problems there.
Wow. What's throughput? Is that what you said, Professor Hoyt? What does that mean?
Right. How many people can you vaccinate in one place at one time?
Well, Governor Chris Sununu recently estimated that the first 10,000 to 15,000 doses of the Pfizer vaccine should be here by December 15th, while 15,000 to 24,000 doses of the Moderna vaccine should arrive about a week later. And obviously, those are developments that NHPR is tracking. Also, the state's nursing homes and assisted living facilities are going to likely work with, this is according to the state, with either CVS or Walgreens to get the vaccine. So that's part of the picture here in New Hampshire. But Professor Fox, overall, who's going to do this? Who's actually going to, you know, sit down and put these vaccines in people's arms?
So these are decisions that are going to have to be made on a state-by-state basis, because there is no national plan for exactly how we do this. Each state is being allocated a certain amount of vaccine, and they're going to have to decide exactly who are those who are in top priority for getting that vaccine and exactly how they're going to distribute it. The most recent plans that I've seen here for Massachusetts say that we're going to, you know, prioritize healthcare workers first, and then move down into the second tier towards frontline workers like teachers and those who are frontward facing. And then, you know, the general public will then sort of come later. But that's going to be a little bit down the road, and it's going to take time for us to be able to build up the capacity to be able to distribute the vaccine to large groups of people.
Well, and we'll hope that those supply chain problems that Professor Hoyt said could happen, often happen in large-scale operations, don't happen. Speaking of who goes first, just yesterday, the state of New Hampshire said school nurses will also be in a high priority phase. You know, Dr. Leahy, putting on your sort of medical ethics hat, who makes these decisions about who goes first, and how are those decisions made?
It takes a village. You can imagine that this is going to happen at different levels of specificity from different bodies. You know, at a national and international level, there are organizations like the National Academies of Science and the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices who sort of say, here are the big groups that healthcare workers should be prioritized because they are so exposed and so critical. that long-term care facility residents are really high risk because they've really shouldered the burden of the death. But then, of course, each state is going to make sort of tailor those recommendations to their realities. And perhaps most importantly to the actual distribution processes, each institution to which vaccines are delivered is going to make similar decisions. So if my hospital gets a certain number of vaccines, they're going to have to get precise about who exactly is a healthcare worker. And so institutions all around the world are making these decisions right now in real time.
Wow, that's kind of a tough place to be, Dr. Leahy, to make those decisions, to say, you know, you can have it and you can't.
Or maybe a better way to think about it is that here's somebody who's at highest risk and so needs to have it first, although, of course, hopefully everybody gets one really soon. They're challenging decisions, but fortunately we have good guidance to go by. We know that we want to prioritize by four common sense factors. You know, one is how likely are you to be exposed to the disease? How likely are you to get severe COVID-19? How likely are you to transmit it to others? And how indispensable are you to our ability to save lives today? So I think if you rank people according to those, this system sort of naturally follows.
Well, and again, New Hampshire's Department of Health and Human Services said in a draft policy that the first phase to get the vaccine will include older adults, as you said, Dr. Leahy, living in residential care settings like nursing homes and assisted living facilities, also first responders and high-risk workers in healthcare facilities, along with the school nurses. So that's what people are saying here in our state, and it sounds like that's being reflected around the country. I want to remind listeners that you can join us with your questions about the vaccine, with the first doses, possibly here in New Hampshire as early as next week. Join us, call 1-800-892-6477. We're taking your questions, comments, concerns about these vaccines that will be coming to our state by this month. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. One more question to you, Dr. Leahy, about sort of who goes first. I have heard some cynicism that the rich and powerful in this country will find a way to jump the line and go first, even if they aren't at high risk, even if they're at low risk. What safeguards, Dr. Leahy, are in place to make sure that, you know, 3 months from now, we're not seeing headlines about, you know, healthy celebrities getting first in line for a shot?
I think it's fantastic that questions like this are coming up. There certainly is a rich history of this pattern happening, whether it was the NBA's access to COVID-19 testing or heck, I guess we don't have time to go through the entire list of examples. So I'm glad that discussion is happening. And for me, it's really important to make sure that we really do hew to those criteria I mentioned, that you know, how early you get a vaccine should be dictated by how at risk you are. And if we follow the logic of that, some of our most marginalized communities and people who have been historically disadvantaged in healthcare are actually at highest risk. So Blacks and Latinos, for instance, have higher risk of contracting infection with SARS-CoV-2. And so I think there's a growing understanding that they therefore need more protection. And I hope thinking like that's going to help us avoid just giving it to white wealthy men like we typically do.
Well, and, you know, Professor Fox, I'd like your thoughts on that too. I mean, many of us remember, what was it called? Operation Varsity Blues, where, you know, wealthy people and celebrities got their kids, you know, through lies and large sums of money, got their kids into elite schools. I mean, what's to prevent an Operation Varsity Blues happening with the vaccine?
Well, it's a really important question. I do think that the attention that is being paid to this, the pandemic, and because everyone is focused on it, all eyes will be on who's getting this vaccine. And I think that, you know, the media has a role to play in identifying these things should they happen. But I also think that, you know, there is so much effort right now going into thinking about how we use these vaccines in the best way to protect the most people as fast as we can, that my hope is that things like this don't happen. I mean, one of the things that we think a lot about is if you know, it's going to take some time before we see the population level benefits of a vaccine, because it's going to take time to get, you know, as many people vaccinated as we need. But if we can target these vaccines towards those who are most at risk of the severest consequences, so, you know, the elderly, the frontline workers, but also, you know, those who are at most at risk from contracting it, we'll hopefully start to see the mortality start to come down, and that will reduce pressure on hospitals and really make things a lot easier as we go forward. So my hope is that we don't see things like we've seen in the past, and that the, you know, equity will really be at the focus of how we distribute this vaccine.
Well, and I've got some questions from listeners about what you said, Professor Fox, the population level benefits. And I will go to those in just a moment. But we've got a caller also from Concord. Shira is on the line. Shira, thanks for calling into the exchange today. Go ahead.
Thanks so much. I actually have two questions for you. The first is, if there are any known effects or benefits for people who are asymptomatic or currently dealing with COVID. And my second question is if there's been any development on a pediatric vaccination.
Oh, great questions, Shira. And I'd like to talk about the first one first. People who already have had COVID, or people who have COVID right now, and unfortunately there are a lot of them. Dr. Leahy, can you answer that question first?
As far as we know, there's no benefit to COVID-19 vaccine in people who have already had it. We know solely so far that it protects people from developing the illness itself. And that leads to an incredibly important unanswered question, which is whether the vaccines protect people from getting infected, even asymptomatically, in a way that would protect them from transmitting. Because you can imagine that maybe I could say, oh, heck, I could get this vaccine and now I don't have to wear a mask and not transmit. But we really don't know that. All we know is it protects you from disease.
That's interesting. And I did read that in the New York Times yesterday, that even if you are vaccinated, you're good to go, you could still give it to other people. Is that what you're saying, Dr. Leahy?
That's a possibility. We don't know the answer to that yet, and it's being hotly researched right now. I'm hopeful that that's the case, but it's just not yet proven.
Yeah, and an elderly man in Britain who got the shot just this week when they started rolling it out said he was looking forward to seeing his grandkids at Christmas. So that's a word of caution there. What about the other part of Shira's question? Maybe you can answer it, Professor Hoyt. Have they done enough testing and research of these vaccines in children? My understanding is no, more needs to be done.
I believe the Pfizer study looked at children as young as 12, but not below. So the clinical trial would have to be expanded to include younger ages.
Yeah, Professor Fox, can you talk about that as well, please?
Yeah, clinical trials in general tend to steer away from populations like pediatric populations, like pregnant women. And so we don't generally get data on those populations right away. So it is absolutely going to take some time and additional trials to be able to identify the safety and the effectiveness. The good news, though, is that, you know, pediatric patients tend to not be as likely to get severe infection. And so, you know, focusing the vaccines that we have available at the moment on those who are older and at most risk of the severe consequences is really a strategy that we need to be pursuing.
Okay. And Dr. Leahy, just to be crystal clear on Shira's point, so if you have had COVID, the vaccine doesn't help you avoid getting it again?
We just don't know. You know, I think a huge unanswered question in the epidemic is whether you have had COVID in the past or if you've been vaccinated and so you have some level of immunity, how long that lasts to protect you. And it's a challenge of the pandemic being so new that we just need more time to observe people to see what really happens. So what I'm hoping is that the COVID-19 vaccine provides protection that's similar to the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine or hepatitis B vaccine that lasts for decades. But we don't know. And of course, all of us know that the flu shot needs to be renewed each year.
Well, Thank you for calling in, Shira. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. So, Professor Hoyt, how does the fact that some of these vaccines require two shots, how does that affect distribution of them among the public? How do you make sure that people show up the second time around?
Yeah, that's going to be a strain on data management. You have to be able to find the same people 30 days later, and you need to be able to execute the same distribution strategy all over again in the same place. And also, this vaccine will be administered under an emergency use authorization, so you have to track symptoms too. So it will be a logistical challenge.
Well, and speaking of logistics, Professor Hoyt, I mean, does our healthcare system have enough people to not only give people the shot in the arm, but do all that follow-up that you've been describing?
Yeah, it's that's a question. We've never done anything on this scale before. There are discussions about recruiting surge capacity, you know, in the form of dentists and veterinarians and all forms of healthcare personnel who might be able to administer a shot.
Wow, that's really interesting. Professor Fox, can you talk about that too, please? Just the workforce that's required to administer the shot and then do that important follow-up.
We just don't have, we've never done anything on the scale of what we are trying to do right now in trying to vaccinate, you know, the majority of the population of the United States and the world on a time frame that we are, you know, people would like to be able to get back to something more normal. And so it's going to take time. It's going to take time to scale up the capacity of healthcare workers who can administer shots. But it's also, as we've talked about, it's going to take time to scale up the number of doses that we have available and the raw materials that are needed and the supply chains that's needed to be able to get these. You know, another challenge that we've talked only a little bit about, but that is worth going back to, is this idea that the requirements for these vaccines are such that they can't be you know, kept in a doctor's office in a refrigerator, which means that they are going to have to exist in centralized locations where you can meet the capacity to be able to store safely these vaccines. And that's going to mean that, you know, people who are living in cities and high density areas are going to be able to access these vaccines faster than in places where, in rural areas, where it's just harder to get to. So there are a lot of hurdles that we still need to get past.
Right, given the fact that, I guess, especially the Pfizer vaccine, from what I understand, has to be kept super, super cold, as Professor Hoyt described. The Moderna vaccine, from what I understand, still needs to be kept very cold, but not quite as cold. There's a lot more to pick up on after a short break, including vaccine education and hesitation. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Old Man Winter is at our doorsteps, and staying active in the coming months may pose a challenge. One solution? Become an NHPR sustainer today for a chance to win a Peloton bike, plus a one-year all-access membership to online classes, both live and on demand. But don't wait. We're picking the lucky winner this Saturday at noon, making your year-end tax-deductible gift as quick and easy at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're answering your questions about coronavirus vaccines, with initial doses expected to arrive in the state as early as next week. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org, or use Facebook. Our guests are Matthew Fox, epidemiology professor at Boston University, Kendall Hoyt, assistant professor at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth College, and Dr. Tim Leahy from the University of Vermont, where he's a professor and an infectious disease physician. And all of you, right back to our listeners. John is calling in from Portsmouth. John, you're on The Exchange. Go ahead, please.
Hi, good morning.
Morning, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm. The disability population has been disproportionately affected and dying from COVID. And I've called the governor's office and my executive counselor, and their response has been discouraging about including members of the disability population in priority positions for the vaccine. And I'm just curious as to what the guests on the show think about that. Thank you.
Yeah, John, thank you very much for calling, because this is a very important topic. And let's see, I think Professor Fox, I'll throw that to you first. Various communities who want the vaccine, but don't appear on the face of it to be quote unquote frontline workers.
Yeah, so there are real challenges in figuring out who to give the vaccine to first. There's two main ways you can think about this. One is we can give it to those who are at higher risk from getting and spreading the infection, or we can give it to those who are most at risk from getting the most severe consequences of the disease, severe disability or death. My personal feeling is that we want to protect those who are at most risk from the severe consequences first, because that will allow us to bring down the mortality, again, reduce that pressure on the hospitals, and allow us to provide better care for those who unfortunately do end up getting sick. So I hear the caller's concern, and I certainly would support prioritizing those who are suffering the most.
Well, we did hear from a couple folks who had concerns about people whose health is more vulnerable. We got an email from Diane who says, are there any pre-existing conditions that would make it inadvisable to be vaccinated? Or would one type of vaccine be preferred over another? Diane says, I have an autoimmune disease. And Diane, thanks for writing. We did get a couple questions like this on our coronavirus survey as well. So, Dr. Leahy, can you address this concern? I've heard it before.
Yeah, I think vaccine safety is really important for all of us to think about. And really importantly, the studies that we have access to so far, this is primarily the Pfizer study, look like the vaccine's quite safe, that side effects are frequent, but we haven't seen red flags in terms of safety. There continues to be this period of observation. These are new vaccines, and so we have to make sure and be really vigilant. There have been concerns raised by interested patient groups, and people with autoimmunity have been among them. There are no data to suggest that there is any added risk in those people. There have been some interesting hypotheses put out there on the internet, but I view them as just interesting ideas. What I care about really is how safe are patients, and we have not seen any worse safety in people with autoimmunity.
Well, and Professor Hoyt, this gets to the, excuse me if I get this wrong, the mRNA, is that right? The sort of different nature of these vaccines. And that has raised some concerns among people with autoimmune disorders, even though Dr. Leahy's telling us that, no, there haven't been any problems detected. But can you just talk a little bit, please, Professor Hoyt, about the different way these vaccines have been created?
Sure. I mean, we have not made vaccines this way before. And it's a very elegant design. It's kind of, I've heard someone say, it's like sending an email to your cells, you know, with instructions to produce proteins that then train your immune system to defend against COVID. So what it is, it's a little snippet of genetic instructions that are delivered in this lipid nanoparticle, and you use your body as a factory to develop the antigen that you need. So you avoid, like traditionally in vaccine development, there's this messy, lengthy process of producing and purifying antigen exogenously, you know, industrially. This is a new way. It's a really fast and flexible platform that can respond quickly to new viruses, as we have seen. Organizations like CEPI, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, invested in this because they thought it would be very useful for rapid turnaround in a pandemic. And it turns out it is. Now they're more, you know, it is a new technology, and we do have to watch it carefully. It does appear to be extremely safe, but we're going to have to follow the data out over time. And we need to improve it over time. I mean, this we're going to clearly need a hardier version. Having these lipid nanoparticles be so sensitive to temperature is a problem. And we need to develop new vaccines that are a little hardier and to temperature. And we are. And there are other things we need to work on as well going ahead. And there's some exciting work being done, build a library of vaccines for diseases with pandemic potential. So you can just pull one out of the fridge when there's a new outbreak to test it. And also really expanding access to this technology, which is extremely cutting edge right now and really, available to high income countries. But there, CEPI again is investing in something called an mRNA printer with a company called CureVac, which would be able to churn out vaccines on site anywhere, which would really increase the capacity and access to these kinds of vaccines in the future.
Yeah, and at some later date, we should definitely talk about the many innovations that people are saying are going to come out of this incredible breakthrough that you described, Professor Hoyt. So that's really interesting because there's a lot of excitement about using this medical technique or technology to address other health issues in our society. But as we talk about concerns that people have, we should talk about vaccine hesitancy. And that has been, as you all know, a growing problem in this country and around the world. And Professor Fox, to you first, please, what discussions are going on right now within the public health community about this?
So a lot of the discussions right now are around what proportion of the population looks like they're going to want to get the vaccine, who's going to be volunteering when the vaccine becomes available, and what proportion of the population will need to get vaccinated in order for us to see the population level benefits. And then, as we look at those numbers, the question becomes, how do we get people to want to take a vaccine that is a new vaccine, but appears, at least from the preliminary data, to be both safe and highly effective? And the numbers that we've seen to date suggest that there is a significant portion of the population that isn't comfortable with these vaccines. My sincere hope is that that is going to change as people start to see the rollout of this vaccine and see the benefits that it has. But what we really need is a strong plan for how we identify those who are not interested in a vaccine and try to understand their concerns, listen to them, and then try to find effective ways to communicate the safety and effectiveness that overcomes those barriers. And that's really where efforts are at the moment.
Well, and Professor Fox, I've got a poll from the Associated Press right in front of me, and it says only about half of American adults right now plan to get the COVID-19 vaccine. Now, there are still large numbers who say, I'm not sure, but among those populations, white Americans, 53% say yes, absolutely. Only 34% of Latinx Americans and only 24% of Black Americans. And yet those are the populations that have been hardest hit by the virus. So what does public health need to do, Professor Fox, to reach out to those groups that do not trust this vaccine?
So this is a historical problem. There is a lot of distrust with the public health and medical care system in the United States due to historical tragedies that have gone on in the past. And so we've got a real barrier to overcome. I think the key to trying to get past that are twofold. Number one is just that as we start to scale up the vaccine and people start to see the benefits that it has, there is certainly hope that people start to view the vaccine in a new light. There's often hesitancy around something that is new, but over time, as people become familiar with people who have been vaccinated and have seen that they have had a successful experience, hopefully some of that starts to go away. But the other is that we need to be working very closely with community groups and community healthcare centers to work on educating the public around what we know about the safety and efficacy of these vaccines so that hopefully we are able to change minds. The other approach that you know, is often used in these cases are media campaigns and social media campaigns that can be effective at getting good information to people so that they really do understand the risk-benefit calculation and understand that there is a lot of benefit, at least as we understand it at the moment, to scaling up these vaccines to a population level.
Let's go back to our listeners. Stephanie's calling from Conway. Hi, Stephanie, you're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I'm a nurse, and I'm also a participant in the COVID-19 AstraZeneca vaccination program out of Portsmouth. So I had my first injection this past Tuesday, and there was a group of us there, about a half dozen. Interestingly, one of them was a doctor and three of us were nurses. So clearly a lot of interest on our part. But we're also had the same question as healthcare providers. We would likely be being offered the Pfizer vaccine. We also understand that these are different type of vaccinations, and we're being told that they're not medically contraindicated in different ways. But I am still struggling with what I'll do when the time comes to actually be offered the Pfizer vaccine at work, because I don't know whether I received the placebo or the real thing. So there's that aspect. And also, in AstraZeneca is not saying what they'll do with us in terms of the data should we get the Pfizer vaccine, because obviously that's going to skew our potential results. So there's a lot of just a little confusion, and just sort of also I'm sort of morally torn, because on one hand, I want to participate in the program to try to advance our knowledge. Hopefully this will be a vaccine, which is quite a bit cheaper as well, which will help a lot of developing third world countries. So, but I'm also mindful of the fact that as a nurse, I potentially am at risk and obviously don't want to risk my life at the same time. So there, but things floating around in my head as I face.
Wow. Yeah, Stephanie, what a conundrum. And I think I'm going to throw this to you, Dr. Leahy. So she's got the AstraZeneca trial going on for her. She doesn't know if she has the real vaccine or the placebo. In the meantime, as a healthcare worker, she would be first in line for the Pfizer vaccine. There's so many unknowns. So I know I'm kind of putting you on the spot, Dr. Leahy, but can you sort of sort through what Stephanie is going through there?
I think this is a great encapsulation of the thinking lots of people are doing. They're sort of trying to weigh the pros and cons and trying to be thoughtful about it. Here's how I would frame it. You know, if we ask the question, what do you think about this vaccine? P.S. There are lots of unknowns. Are you worried? Naturally, one's thinking goes to the worries and the unknown. And that makes sense. You know, we have only seen detailed data on the Pfizer vaccine, and we still await more on the others. It'll come shortly. And so naturally, if you say, would you like this vaccine that I can't give you a lot of details about? It makes sense to be a little bit standoffish. So one, we're going to get more information and be able to be precise about it. And we're going to see Dr. Fauci and other trusted figures get vaccinated, and that's going to be helpful. And the way I think about it is to not say, well, what are the pros and cons of the vaccine, but really, what are the pros and cons for protection against this illness of the vaccine? And in that way, I can say that, for instance, in the United States, we've had 289,451 deaths from this pandemic, and many more in other countries. And we have had zero deaths and very few serious consequences of these vaccines. We're keeping an eye on them, but to me, the much bigger threat here is the disease. And so I'm gonna roll up my sleeve and get a shot.
All right, well, Stephanie, good luck to you, and it's great to hear from you. You're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. You know, Professor Fox, another thing that comes out for me from Stephanie's call is the people who participate in the vaccine trials, and there is one going on out of Portsmouth, New Hampshire, so, you know, some listeners have experience with this. What if you participate in a vaccine trial, Professor Fox, and you get the dummy shot? once the vaccine is approved, do you have first in line rights to the real vaccine? Because I read one vaccine trial participant say, look, if you don't do that, no one's going to participate in these trials. So how are public health officials talking with the companies about that, Professor Fox?
So first of all, I would just thank Stephanie for her participation in this trial. We rely on people to volunteer for efforts like these so that we can generate data on the safety and efficacy of these trials. So that's really, really important, and I really appreciate that. To answer the specific question, I don't know the specifics of this particular trial protocol, but what I would say is the trials are typically, like these of vaccines, have a period of time during which they cannot unblind the information, meaning they can't tell you whether you got the placebo or the actual injection. And that is so that you don't change your behavior in order, you know, because you know you got the injection or you got the placebo. And that would change the way that we would be able to interpret the results. But these trials typically have plans for when they will unblind that information and how they will provide the vaccine to those who got the placebo if they were in the placebo arm and when that should happen. So I would encourage her to contact the trial authorities to understand what the exact process is so that she can then be ready for what will happen when she's in line for the vaccines through the general, you know, general rollout.
So here's an email from Brian who says, since this first vaccine has to be shipped at very low temperatures, and I assume it cannot be injected at those temperatures, how is it warmed, Brian asks, and how long after can it be used? Brian, great question. And Professor Hoyt, can you address that, please?
Yeah, they take it out of the freezer and it stays 5 days in the refrigerator. And beyond that, it goes bad. So there is a process of unfreezing it.
So it has to be unfrozen precisely, yes. I'm guessing, so it doesn't get spoiled. And then it's injected into somebody's arm. Is that
correct,
right, Professor Hoyt?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Lots more to wade through after a very short break. We'll talk with our guests about the costs of these vaccines, because as our caller Stephanie said, the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is not as close to approval as the Pfizer and the Moderna, is said to be much cheaper. It can be distributed all over the world. So we should definitely talk about that after a short break. Keep your calls and emails coming in. It's great to hear from you this morning. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, an update on COVID-19 vaccines. And listeners, what comments, questions, concerns do you have? Let us know. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 800-892-6477. We have three guests. Matthew Fox is an epidemiology professor at Boston University. Kendall Hoyt, assistant professor at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth College. And Dr. Tim Leahy from the University of Vermont, where he's a professor and an infectious disease physician. And Professor Hoyt, a lot of listeners want to know who pays for these vaccines and how much will they cost the individual person?
Well, the government has paid for these vaccines. Operation Warp Speed funded the development and the purchase of a number of vaccines, you know, to the tune of $10 billion. And the CARES Act will reimburse providers for administering the vaccine. So even if you don't have health insurance, you can access this vaccine from a wide variety of providers that you might not automatically go to or normally go to. That represents the acute phase of this pandemic. There's a lot of public pressure to keep the price low in this emergency phase, but the pharmaceutical companies do intend to make a profit on this vaccine. So each company has negotiated different prices with the government for this initial phase. I think Pfizer is close to $20 a dose. Moderna's higher, $25 to $37 a dose. AstraZeneca, much lower, closer to $3 a dose. And, you know, this will, you know, we, after the acute phase, we will start paying for vaccines in the normal way. And I think, you know, one thing to point out, though, is that a lot of these contracts are not available for viewing and analysis. It's really hard to FOIA them. And when you get the contracts back, they're heavily redacted.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Arguably one of the most important procurements in U.S. history. We need to be able to look at these contracts. We have to be able to see if the public interest is adequately represented in these contracts.
And FOIA is the Freedom of Information Act, by which journalists and professors like you get a hold of that information. So that's interesting.
So well, that's the way ahead.
We talked earlier about vaccine hesitancy and concerns around that. We've got a couple listeners who are not hesitant at all. Kathleen in Northampton wrote to our coronavirus survey. She says, I can't wait for the vaccine, any vaccine. Kathleen says, I will definitely be taking it. Also, Andrea in Hopkinton wrote to our survey. She says, I was newly elected to the Hopkinton School Board just days before the pandemic caused the schools to go full remote. As vice chair, Andrea says, these past 10 months have been incredibly trying. As I try to balance the economic needs of our community, the social emotional needs of students and our faculty, the educational needs of our district, Andrea says, I cannot wait to get the vaccine because there's so much work to be done to stitch our lives and our communities back together. By the way, listeners, we'd love for you to fill out our coronavirus survey. Tell us how it's affecting your lives. That's at nhpr.org. Let's go back to our listeners. Steve is calling from Concord. Hi, Steve. You're on the Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm normally Steve from Nottingham, but I'm a doctor, and I've been having a nagging question. Why is it you need two shots 21 days apart, where the other vaccines, you just get one shot?
That's a good question, although I think, Dr. Leahy, it isn't always other vaccines only require one shot. I remember a couple vaccines with my kids when they were little where I did have to go back. But go ahead, Dr. Leahy, please.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Laura. There are shots like the hepatitis B shot that require a few shots, measles, mumps, and rubella. Many of us remember our booster shots. And why one shot has one dose and another vaccine has multiple ultimately gets down to how much you need to stimulate the immune system to generate a protective response. And basic science studies of the vaccines we're looking at now suggested that that second shot really boosts the immune response into levels that scientists predict are probably protective. We think that one dose might be helpful, but two appears to really make powerful immune responses we're more optimistic about.
So Dr. Leahy, on that point, the vaccines that seem closest to approval all have very high efficacy rates in the 90 plus percentage zone. What does that mean exactly, Dr. Leahy, that if I get vaccinated with the Pfizer vaccine, I get that double dose, I have a 95% chance of not getting COVID?
Yeah, so the two vaccines that we've seen the most information about are the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines. The Pfizer vaccine's the only one that we have really, really detailed information about, and they both suggest efficacy rates across the whole population of 90-95%. And you can imagine that it might be different from person to person. And so we're all looking forward to seeing how well does it work in people who are over 65 and how well does it work in women versus men? You know, all those questions are unfolding this week. But yes, the hope is that if those data are true, that your likelihood of getting the disease is reduced by about 95%. And that is a big deal to me. It's going to make us all feel more comfortable. We can socialize in time the way we want to, and it'll be easier for the economy to get back to booming like we all want it.
Well, and back to booming, back to normal. That's a theme that we heard from a lot of listeners, all of you. Laura and Jaffrey wrote on our survey. She says, I don't believe we will resume a life of normalcy for at least a year. It will take that long for vaccines and immunity from those who had COVID to reach a level where we will be unmasked. And Professor Fox, that's the big question, really, isn't it? How long do we have to, you know, put up with all this? What's your sense at this point, Professor Fox?
No, so I think that that comment is exactly right. I think that we are going to start to hopefully see the benefits of the rollout of the vaccines starting in probably in the late spring as we start to move into population level distribution and we start to see transmission hopefully coming down. Although, as Dr. Leahy pointed out, we don't yet know the specifics of whether or not the vaccine is effective at reducing transmission. At this point, we only know that it's effective at reducing disease, but the hope is that that will translate into reduced transmission. But it's going to take some time before we can scale up the proportion of the population that's vaccinated or previously infected and has immunity to the point at which we see life going back to normal. So we're still going to be wearing masks and distancing, but I think that some of the restrictions that we have in place now can start to be eased once the vaccine scale up continues. So I don't think we are going to continue on in the same way that we are now, where we're really in the thick of things and are trying our best to mitigate the severe impacts while we get the vaccine up and scaled up. But things are not going to probably return to complete normal until late next year.
Okay, so that's a key question mark then, isn't it, Professor Fox? The question that we don't know yet, and I think Dr. Leahy said this earlier, that if you have gotten the vaccine, we still don't know if you are capable of transmitting COVID. Is that right, Professor Fox? That seems to be the outstanding question. Yeah.
No, it absolutely is right. But I do want to emphasize that doesn't mean that it doesn't reduce transmission. It just means that at this point, we don't know. The vaccine trials were designed to assess the outcome of developing disease, you know, severe enough that you would get tested and present to a healthcare provider. So we know that these vaccines are highly effective against getting the disease. What we don't know is whether or not there is the possibility that one can have the infection, not show signs of the disease, but still effectively pass that on to others. But, you know, that doesn't mean that the vaccine doesn't prevent infection. It means it's just an unknown. Again, the hope now is, though, that if we are to vaccinate those who are at most risk of severe illness and they never get sick, then we are effectively starting to protect the population because those who are unvaccinated would still have a lower risk of getting sick anyway because they are younger and healthier. So it's going to take some time before we know, but that is the hope.
Here's another question for you, Professor Fox. Will people get to choose which vaccine they get? I mean, this is down the line, I understand, but we've got Pfizer coming probably soon, Moderna probably coming soon after that. AstraZeneca, you know, has had some bumps, but that is in development. So, Professor Fox, do people get to choose or is it, you know, does it make a difference, I guess?
So I would defer a bit to my colleagues on this, but there's a lot of unknowns here, but I think that the procurement of these vaccines is, you know, largely down to the contracts that the U.S. government has with the particular providers. And so I think in many places there's going to be limited number of each of these vaccines in different places, particularly after we get through this first set of vaccines that are targeted towards healthcare workers, such that we may only have one vaccine available for people.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. Dr. Leahy, do you want to take a crack at that as well? I mean, are different vaccines better for certain types of people? Do we get to pick which kind we want, or does it matter?
You know, in the United States, we like to be able to have unfettered choice, and it's tough for us to
right. 16 kinds of ketchup.
Told.
Yeah.
Which one? Yeah. I think it's going to depend on when you're talking about. You know, early on, we have perhaps one or two vaccines that are going out. And as we've discussed this morning, they have different challenges of distribution, and that's probably going to shape who has access to them. you can imagine that healthcare workers are much more likely to be exposed to the Pfizer vaccine because it's going to be easier to administer it where they work. Whereas the Moderna one's a little more flexible, and it may be that in time, other vaccines get out into the general population so that in later phases, there is more choice. And certainly if it's just as easy to get a few different vaccines to a group of people and it's possible to have choice, then nobody's philosophically opposed to that. I suspect though that what's near you is gonna dictate what you get.
Well, and Professor Hoyt, you know, is someone again who looks at manufacturing, distribution of these critical vaccines. What are you going to be watching in the next couple weeks?
First, I would just add to that former point briefly that, you know, we're going to get more information about the characteristics of these vaccines, and you're going to want to tailor it to your prioritization strategy. Does one work better in elderly populations? Does one reduce transmission? Does one reduce severity? And that should really determine our prioritization strategy going forward.
Go ahead, Professor Hoyt.
Things to look forward to. I think an issue that we're gonna face, we're gonna be vaccinating more people than ever before. And there will be, we're gonna have to work overtime to sort out what is a vaccine-related event and what's not a vaccine-related event. There will be heart attacks, there will be strokes, there will be cancer diagnoses, and all of this will get attributed to the vaccine. And so we're gonna really have to sort it out and communicate clearly, because we need to maintain trust in the process to keep acceptance rates up.
Well, I really appreciate all of you being with us. This is such an important topic. So thank you very much for your time. Today's show was produced by Exchange Fellow Jane Vaughn, and you've been listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.